This is Pittsburgh Explainer from 90.5 WESA. Every week, we help you catch up on the headlines from southwestern Pennsylvania. It's Friday, January 15th. Thanks for joining us. I'm Lucy Perkins, in for Liz Reed. So far, the COVID-19 vaccine rollout has been slow and uneven, to say the least. The Trump administration promised 20 million Americans would be vaccinated by the end of 2020. But as of this week, only about 10 million people have gotten the first shot, and only about 500,000 people have received the full two-dose vaccine. WESA's health and science reporter Sarah Bowden has been investigating how the rollout has gone so far in Pittsburgh. She reported a story this week which revealed that some UPMC staff who have been working remotely since the pandemic started were inoculated before frontline workers. And she's here now to talk about it. Sarah, thanks for being on Explainer.
Hey, Lucy.
Okay, so first off, we should say that there are plenty of healthcare workers at UPMC who have been vaccinated. But tell me about the people you talk to. What kind of work do they do? Who are they?
Sure. So in addition to clinicians, I've spoken to or identified via social media people who are service coordinators, people who work in fundraising, insurance services, communications. Many of these people do not work in medical facilities, and some of these folks have been working from home since the start of the pandemic.
Wow. Okay. Well, there are rules about who gets to get a vaccine first. So how did this happen?
So state and federal officials and guidelines say that not only should clinicians and frontline healthcare workers be included in the first group to get vaccinated, group 1A, but also people who maybe don't work directly in patient care, but work in healthcare settings and therefore could contract the coronavirus and spread it to clinicians or patients. But it seems that UPMC has really quite broadly interpreted these state guidelines to include folks, again, who, well, maybe do things that are essential to delivering patient care, who are able to do their jobs from home and could continue to work from home for some time.
One of the points you make in your story, which you reported with Kylie Kaczynski and Liz Reed, is that hospitals are supposed to save 10% of the doses that they get for unaffiliated medical providers. But that's been a confusing process, too. So tell me who we're talking about here and where those roadblocks are.
Yeah, so a big part of the problem is that only now are public health systems and large hospitals, only now are they standing up processes to connect to unaffiliated independent healthcare providers. I'm talking about dialysis centers, dental offices, small community health centers. And as a result, it's just been super confusing. Kylie spoke with a number of providers who just ended up cold calling different places to see if they could get the vaccine. There hasn't been, up until very recently, great guidance to try and coordinate. It's kind of almost like matchmaking. We have this much vaccine and these many providers, and trying to get the vaccine and the providers to the same place. It takes a lot of coordination and a lot of organization. And up until very recently, that hasn't happened. And by the way, this was totally avoidable. I reported back in October that this was a big concern, that vaccine distribution, it was a big concern that it would be super messy. And a lot of the blame rests with the federal government. The federal government could have allocated funding to make sure that this process would have been more organized and thoughtful. And that hasn't happened. And so therefore, we're in the situation that we're in now. I will say that at the end of December, funding was allocated, and so now we're public health departments around the country are waiting to receive that funding to try and make sure that essential frontline healthcare workers are getting vaccinated. But again, this could have been avoided.
My last question, Sarah, is if the whole point is to just get people vaccinated, I guess I'm wondering, like, does it really matter if a few people get lucky and get vaccinated earlier than they expected?
Clearly, right now, it's more than a few. But no, it doesn't matter that, you know, some random person gets vaccinated before maybe they should, according to state and federal guidelines. The issue is that there are people who desperately need vaccine, who are at high risk of contracting the virus because of what they do, who are still waiting for vaccine. But now that this issue has been pointed out, there is an opportunity to make the systematic changes necessary to fix this problem.
Sarah, thanks so much for your reporting.
No problem. Thanks, Lucy.
It's time for a quick break. We will be right back.
I pledge to be a president who seeks not to divide, but unify.
After a turbulent transition of power, Joe Biden now inherits many challenges in a divided nation. He's set to be inaugurated on the same stage where rioters overtook the Capitol. I'm Rachel Martin. Join NPR Wednesday for special live coverage of the inauguration from NPR News.
Until everyone's vaccinated, jobs that can't be done remotely are just riskier. Obviously, jobs in hospitals and nursing homes fall into that category, but also food service and retail. And some essential workers in those industries have demanded hazard pay, extra compensation for being put in situations where they could be exposed to the virus. But few employers have offered the benefit. WESA's Anlie Herring covers government and accountability and joins me now to talk about why that is. Hey, Anlie.
Hey, Lucy. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. So I imagine when the pandemic hit, a lot of businesses were looking for money to cover new costs like hazard pay. What resources were available then?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, at the start of the pandemic, we really had this increase in appreciation of frontline essential workers and a growing awareness of the fact that a lot of them make low wages. And some companies decided to give their workers bonuses, and the term that you started to hear was hero's pay, and that was just to show the appreciation for essential workers and also support them through this period. Hazard pay was also an idea that started to get more support, although it hasn't really taken off at a lot of employers, and one issue is that there aren't all that many resources for it. Pennsylvania created a fund later in the summer last year using some of its Federal CARES Act money, $50 million specifically. And that money was for workers making less than $20 an hour. It would add $3 to their hourly wages. And those workers would have to be in certain industries like healthcare, janitorial services, transportation. The funds were quite limited, so ultimately only about 6% of the 10,000 employers that applied for it actually got these grants.
Wow, okay. So what kind of businesses did get help?
Well, looking at the list of the 640 recipients, you do see a lot of long-term care facilities for older people. They're pretty heavily represented. In the story I did on this topic with Kate Giamarisi, we do note that there really aren't big hospitals that people would recognize on the list, even though those are definitely places where there are a lot of these frontline essential workers. You also see some janitorial service companies. There were some local food service outlets that I saw on the list. But by and large, mostly small to medium-sized businesses.
I can imagine that, you know, 6% is a pretty low number of applicants who actually got funds. I imagine it was pretty confusing for businesses that didn't get any help. What did you hear from those business owners?
Yeah, so Kate and I talked with a representative for an advocacy organization for long-term care facilities like nursing homes, and he said that among his membership, there were similar facilities that got different results when it came to their grant applications. Some of them got the money, some didn't, and it wasn't really apparent to them what the difference was. And then also someone from the local child care advocacy group Trying Together said that a high proportion of facilities that they represent that applied did not get the money. And that was really confusing to them because in the child care industry, you know, these are frontline employees. They're going into work every day. There's a lot of interaction with the kids, with coworkers, and a lot of these workers get quite low wages. So the group was kind of at a loss as to why they didn't get more of the money.
As you said, you know, $50 million doesn't go that far when there are so many businesses impacted by the pandemic. What are the odds that the grant program gets replenished?
Well, it's pretty unclear right now. I mean, Congress did not include hazard pay funding in its latest COVID relief package, although when the Democrats first drafted their version of the legislation, they did include a hazard pay fund, but that was eliminated during negotiations. There also wasn't money for state government, so Pennsylvania doesn't really have a new injection of cash to run a new hazard pay funding program. But because the Democrats won both of those runoff elections in Georgia for the Senate, they now have a very slim majority in the Senate and also continue to control the House. So it's possible that they'll find a way to boost the funding and include some for hazard pay.
Well, Anlie, thank you for your reporting.
Thank you.
It's time for another break. Stay with us.
When you donate your old car, truck, or boat to WESA, we'll come and get it at no cost to you. You'll get a tax-deductible receipt, and you'll be supporting NPR in Pittsburgh. RVs, trailers, and motorcycles are accepted, too. To learn more about the WESA vehicle donation program, visit wesa.fm/cars or call 855-905-WESA. That's 855-905-9372.
Republicans in the Pennsylvania State House advanced a proposed constitutional amendment this week that critics say would effectively gerrymander state courts. Keystone Crossroads reporter Miles Bryan covered the legislative activity in Harrisburg, and he joins me now. Hey, Miles.
Hey.
Okay, so what is this proposal?
So this is a bill that would put a constitutional amendment to Pennsylvania voters. And it basically asks voters if they would like to scrap the current system for electing appellate court judges. So appellate court means appeals court. Pennsylvania has three of them, the Commonwealth, Superior, and Supreme Courts. And the current system for electing those judges is statewide elections. So everybody in the state gets to vote for every judge. The constitutional amendment asks if folks want to scrap that system in favor of regional elections. So judges would be elected by region.
So how would that change the makeup of state courts? What's the makeup right now, and how could that change?
Well, the short answer is it would likely mean a lot more conservative or Republican judges. So these are partisan elections. And, you know, Lucy, folks who've been following this story might know that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court is controlled by Democrats right now and has been pretty active in basically making state Republicans mad for the last couple of years. So, you know, this idea of rejiggering the courts to make them friendlier to Republicans has been around for a long time, but it kind of came up again most recently in 2018 when the Pennsylvania Supreme Court threw out the congressional maps that had been drawn by the Republican legislature and approved by a Republican governor. The Supreme Court said at the time that these are totally bogus and they unfairly sort of group people so that Democrats have less of an advantage than Republicans. And the court ended up drawing its own maps, and that really pissed off a lot of Republican legislators. And then most recently, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court has rejected many, many lawsuits and other legal challenges to Joe Biden's victory here in Pennsylvania, and to Governor Tom Wolf's use of emergency power. So, you know, most watchers, experts, and certainly Democrats say that this move to, you know, in the long term, switch out a lot of Democratic judges and replace them with Republican ones is a move in retribution to some of these rulings we've been seeing over the last few years.
Right, because the argument here is that Republicans are making would in some ways prioritize the votes of more rural areas of the state, because you'd be kind of splitting up these districts, you know, maybe having Pittsburgh and Philly in one and having, you know, three or four or however many in the central part of the state, which is predominantly Republican.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the sponsor, Representative Russ Diamond from Lebanon County, he said Wednesday in the hearing that he really is concerned about diversity, but he's really concerned about geographic diversity. You know, he pointed out that most of the 31 appellate court judges are from Allegheny or Philadelphia counties right now. So if you did this, it would mean there would be more judges from places like Lebanon County or McKean County or Tioga County or what have you. You know, as you know, much of the state of Pennsylvania outside of the Pittsburgh and Philadelphia region is quite conservative. and is much more Republican. Critics say that this would disenfranchise people who live in cities in kind of a similar way that the, say, Senate map on a national level results in, Wyoming having one senator per 250,000 people and, California having one senator per 25 million. But that's the argument here, that it would bring more geographic diversity to the courts.
All right. Well, let's talk about what happens next. In Pennsylvania, in order to amend the state constitution, legislation has to pass in two consecutive legislative sessions. That already happened in the past legislative session. Obviously, 2021 starts a new session, and legislators have already passed or are on their way to passing this in the House. What happens next?
As you pointed out, this this bill proposing a constitutional amendment already passed last session. Now we're back, and it's sort of worth noting how fast this is moving. Yesterday was sort of the first meeting of the Judicial Committee, the first time this could come up in the House. I think one Democratic lawmaker noted that in that meeting, they're normally like setting rules. They're not usually considering, considering stuff of substance like this. But Republicans are moving it quick. It passed out of the House Judicial Committee just barely, 13 to 12, with two Republicans jumping ship and voting with Democrats. So this is a controversial idea. But now it goes to the GOP-controlled House, and if it passes there, goes to the Senate. And if it passes there, Governor Wolf can't veto it. This is not something that's up for his veto. And if it doesn't hit any roadblocks, which, it's possible it would, because this is all fast and legislation can be screwed up by a bunch of stuff, it could be on voters' ballots for the May primary. Democrats, sort of good government experts, point out that if it gets to the ballot on the May primary, this is a primary election and an off year after a presidential election. There are very good odds that there's going to be far fewer voters actually considering whether to change the Constitution to adopt this than there would be in, say, a presidential election year. So, again, this might end up being, this might end up drastically reshaping the courts in the Commonwealth based on the input of a relatively small proportion of the eligible voters.
Miles, thanks for your reporting. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That's Pittsburgh Explainer for this week. Our show is produced by Katie Blackley. Larkin Page Jacobs is our managing editor. And you can find all of our news coverage at our website, WESA.FM. And of course, on the air at 90.5 FM. I'm Lucy Perkins. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week.